Now for the talk this afternoon, I just want to start with a disclaimer that the point of this talk is not as an introductory explanation of oppression. If that is the sort of thing that you are looking for, I really recommend that you head to the Marxism 101 session tomorrow at 2 p.m. in the Yellow Room, which is about understanding sexism and oppression. This is more of an intervention into a series of debates on the left around the question of oppression that have been going on for the past few years. But Sarah here is going to be addressing those debates. So Sarah's now a longtime member of Socialist Alternative. She's on our national executive, is also a member of the Sydney branch where I am, and has been a tireless fighter and activist against oppression in all its forms for some years now. So please make her feel welcome, and we'll have discussion once she wraps up.
Yeah, so as Ellie said, this talk is, you know, dealing with some of the debates that have arisen recently about how to understand oppression. And through looking at those, I hope to kind of, you know, display or kind of elucidate some of the Marxist approach to understanding oppression. Okay, so the reason to do this now, I suppose, is that I think there's been a bit of a break with the identity politics hegemony, which for a long time was just seen as the common sense only way to understand oppression and to be involved in struggles against it. And I think it's a really positive change that's been somewhat broken, but there are also problems with some of the theoretical points and political arguments made by those on the left who see themselves as kind of strident critics of identity politics. So to start with, just looking at identity politics briefly, it's not a strict school of thought, but rather a method of thinking that became increasingly prevalent on the left from the late 70s onwards. And that was a time that saw the end of an era of radical struggles, the liberation struggles, or the rights struggles, as people refer to them, for a whole series of rights for oppressed groups. But it also marked the end of a period of radical working class militancy that had preceded it. And broadly speaking, identity politics is an approach that calls for members of distinct oppressed groups to advance their interests by binding together against those who do not face that oppression. It emphasises the common experience faced by a particular category of oppressed group, and it assumes a lack of empathy from people who are outside of that group. The process of challenging oppression, therefore, is focused on discussing personal experiences shared in common by members of that group, by calling out the privilege of others, and by celebrating the achievements of members of that oppressed group, you know, when they ascend in various ways. And there are a series of theories and approaches, sort of political tendencies that are encompassed under the identity politics umbrella. And this talk is not about going through all of those, but just to give people a sense of it, some of them are whiteness theory, which was something that was first developed by some Maoists in the late 60s as part of the struggles for black rights, but sort of devolved and became taken up in various forms since then. Today's proponents of whiteness theory, for example, are David Roediger and also a more contemporary figure, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and they sort of talk about white supremacy a fair bit, or Coates does. Privilege theory and call-out politics, which Harsha did an introduction about yesterday, is also part of identity politics. And as too is intersectionality theory, which was first developed as a sort of legalistic theory in the 80s since then sort of took on a broader meaning and is used much more broadly. So intersectionality theory is obviously seen as a more left-wing articulation of identity politics, though I think it shares many of the same features as other approaches to identity politics. Practically, identity politics has infused collective organising against oppression. It's infused the culture at like university campuses in a lot of different campaign groups. It's used frequently to attack the Marxist left and also to attack the relevance, the idea that working class movements are still relevant. It's also used quite frequently and prevalently by unions, union officials and so on. And more it's used cynically by sections of the ruling class who want to use it to promote their progressive credentials. So Alan Joyce, the Qantas CEO who put rainbow insignia or branding on his planes, whilst basically attacking the workers there for demanding higher wages, that kind of stuff. So there's some more leftish and some more right-wing iterations of identity politics. But I think one quote, just to kind of try and summarise some of its approach that's useful, is by a queer theorist called Jeffrey Escoffier, who said this in 1985. And he's speaking positively. This is a comment on the virtues of identity politics. He says, "The politics of identity must be seen as the politics of difference. The politics of difference affirms limited, partial being. We are now in a period of decline and discouragement. We have no objective guarantee that the working class recognises capitalism as the cause of the injustice and inequalities of American life. The recent history of the American working class clearly shows that it lacks the organisational and political capacity to struggle effectively for the fundamental transformation of society." And I think that really sums up the conclusions and approach of identity politics. And I think that we can very much see that still alive and well today, that exact response to the working class, denigrating them as, the problem, as a layer in society that has no interest or ability to fight capitalism or to mobilise at a mass level against oppression. And we can see some of that come through in the discussions about what led to the victory of Trump. There's a lot of people on the identity politics left who were very quick to jump on the lie peddled by the media that it was the white working class that facilitated Trump's rise to the White House. But as I said, on the other hand, over the last few years, there has actually been a challenge to identity politics. There's been somewhat of an opening up of space to critique it and to offer an alternative and a more class-focused view on oppression. And I think that this shift has begun to occur for a few reasons. The economic crisis in 2008 is very much the political backdrop, the economic backdrop of our world now. And that has brought class inequalities into stark relief in a way that can't just be ignored. There's various reflections of that, I think. One was the Occupy movement, which happened in 2011. And raised the slogan, "We're the 99% against the 1%, which I think is very much an iteration of the world of society being organised in a class way. There's a general sense of there's a kind of profound economic inequality that pervades everything, and that's really clear for people on the left in America, but also more and more here. It's something that's just part of common discourse. There are a lot of institutions and people talking about wage stagnation and how bad it is that there's, a working poor and the attacks on the working class go on and so on. Recently, there's also been a real following emerge for the likes of Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn, two very white, very male political figures who have had a resonance with people because of the fact that they basically articulate a class sentiment about opposing the class inequalities in society. And I think the other major contributing factor to the discrediting of identity politics is the cynical adoption of its tropes by the likes of Hillary Clinton and Alan Joyce, as I mentioned before. That's become a quite obscene spectacle, and most people on the left cannot sort of stomach the fact that she tries to parade around as some fighter for women's rights simply because she happens to be a woman. Okay, so as a result of these things, some well-known proponents of identity politics have even come out to criticise it. So if people are familiar with Bell Hooks, who's a sort of leftish feminist, black feminist in the US, when Sanders originally came on the scene, she said of him that he represented the continuum of patriarchal power reasserting itself. A few months after that, though, she decided to support him against Clinton and, quote, "There are certain things that I don't want to co-sign in the name of feminism that I think are militarist, imperialist, and white supremacist. And then she sort of invoked James Baldwin to say, the key question is not your identity, but who you are and what do you stand for. David Roediger, who is seen as one of the kind of original theorists of whiteness theory, also recently admitted in the introduction to his new book, quote, "I think we may be due for a discussion on whether white privilege now serves us well in naming patterns of white advantage inside a system in which most people are miserable." So I think that is a reflection of what's going on. There's also been a renewed interest in Marxism as a way of, as a tool to kind of explain the world in crisis in general, rising class inequality, but also oppression, to offer a critique of identity politics. And I think many of the political arguments that purport to be Marxist and that have taken up this space are unfortunately quite crude and reductionist critiques of identity politics that do not actually arm us with the Marxist opposition to identity politics in the way they set out to. And so that's what I want to spend the rest of the talk dealing with. So one group in particular that have kind of come to the fore to argue against identity politics and liberalism in general, they call themselves the anti-essentialists, or another term that they share with others is class-first Marxists. And the anti-essentialists kind of crew, some of their well-known members are Adolf Reed, who's been a political commentator and writer for a very long time but has recently become fashionable, also Walter Ben Michaels and Cedric Johnson. Now, of this group, many of their critiques that they make of identity politics, I think Marxists should agree with, and people in this room, you know, should agree with. They argue, for example, that identity politics has become a wing of neoliberalism. So Reed says, "Identity politics is not an alternative to class politics, it is a class politics, the politics of left-wing neoliberalism. It's the expression and active agency of a political order and moral economy in which capitalist market forces are treated as unassailable nature." And I think it's undeniably the case that identity politics, in the way he describes, not only sidesteps the question of class, but actually raises an attack on the working class and can be, as I sort of went through, actively engaged to promote and defend capitalism. But the anti-essentialists go further than this, because they argue that the problem is not just identity politics, but in fact any recognition of identity, any identification by a group of people of their shared oppression. So they say that it is the very categorisation of identity on the basis of traits other than class, so race and gender, whether that identification be being made by the ruling class or by members of that oppressed group who are also working class, that in and of itself is reactionary because it buys into false constructions that are used to paper over and undermine the rights and struggles of the working class. And they call this process ascriptive essentialism. So Reed describes the problems with ascriptive essentialism like this. Ascriptive hierarchies sort populations into categories of classification that are in principle set off from one another by clear, uncrossable boundaries. Gender is one such ascriptive category. Within its compass, a person can be only either male or female. And each classification carries with it a normatively and until recently legally prescribed range of possible locations within the social division of labour and civic entitlement. So Reed and the other anti-essentialists then go on to argue that there's nothing meaningful or valid about identity characteristics and that to confer legitimacy on these social constructions is just an exercise in backing up the status quo. So they criticise not just the people who embrace very clearly essentialist tropes, like the idea that femininity is good and should be celebrated. women should be seen as nurturers and carers, and that's how women have always been, and you know that's timeless and natural. They don't just criticise that as essentialism. They literally criticise anyone who seeks to classify, identify, or organise around these categories. So in this view, anyone who refers to themselves as a woman or part of the women's movement or black or part of a black movement or talks about the way women's sexuality is stigmatised or any of these things is buying into these ascriptive essentialist categories. And I think this completely misunderstands the way in which race and gender are socially constructed and it misunderstands the contradictions within these constructions. Because of course, Marxists have to see that race and gender are not real, they're not innate, they're not essential characteristics, they are social constructions. And it is true that many proponents of identity politics attribute a sort of primordial character to particular groups. But it's also the case that these constructions have a real material basis. People do get treated differently and experience the world differently because of these traits that they have been assigned. So every category, including class, is both constructed and real. And Louise... Louise O'Shea, in the Marxist Left Review article about the construction of women as a social category, refers to it like this. Marxists recognise that women can at the same time comprise a meaningful social category and be hopelessly divided to the point where that category itself is legitimately called into question because of the counterposed material interests between exploiting and exploited members of that group. They are both united and divided in an ongoing contradiction. So the social construction of a category, such as gender, is real. People are assigned these traits. That doesn't mean that it's not contradictory or doesn't present, you know, problems in terms of always characterising people as part of that. But in the same way, class is actually a social construction as well. Though class as a identity doesn't run into the trouble of bridging like cross-class boundaries, it's still the case that class is an identity that has that is subjectively and objectively taken up. So people can objectively be part of the working class but go around identifying as middle class, and, you know, materially the fact that they actually are working class will assert itself at some point if their boss tries to fire them or so on. Similarly, black people can walk around saying they're not black, but if they're walking down the street in America and the police shoot them because they have black skin, that is society, you know, assigning them as black. And this, I think, relates to another point about the assigning of, or the kind of adoption of different characteristics and identity groupings. Because the anti-essentialists say that the reason identity characteristics and that kind of classification of people is reactionary is because it's a cultural process that's about people binding together with people who are actually hostile to their interests and so on. But I don't think Marxists should see that as the source of the problem. The reason that it's the capitalist ideology assigns people different category, you know, socially constructs different categories like women, blacks and so on, is not first and foremost to culturally bind people together in that identification. It's to enact racism, mm-hmm. or it's to enact sexism. And if people are interested in this question, they should read Barbara Fields and Karen Fields' book about it, Racecraft, where they say that race is not the social construction that leads to racism. Racism is the social construction that leads to race. And actually, if you focus in on the cultural identification in the way that the anti-essentialists do, then you miss the point of actually discussing the construction of racism and sexism. And you'll find, if you read these anti-essentialist writings, they never talk about the construction, the material construction of things like racism and sexism. So the other thing is, though, it leads to a totally undifferentiated political assessment of the people that take on these different characteristics. So we can agree that there's nothing real or valid about these categories in some innate, timeless way. But actually, you have to have a political subjective interpretation of why and how and what the political implications are of people taking on these characteristics or becoming someone who identifies a particular group at a particular point in time. So, for example, it is right-wing, when ruling class people of a particular oppressed group try to use that to polish up their image and so on. It is not right-wing, and it's not in the service of capitalism when Palestinians identify themselves as a category, a group of people who are fighting for their homeland, women identify themselves as an oppressed group fighting for equal pay, and so on. So it actually ends up denying the progressive characteristics of social movements that actually rely on people coming to some united collective understanding of their shared oppression, which also correlates with a shared taking up of that identity. Okay, another point to add, I think, in this discussion is that it's often actually quite a problem when identity categories are not articulated. And I think that this is something that anti-essentialists can't understand either. Because under neoliberalism, it has been very consciously a strategy of the ruling class to kind of try and evoke colour blindness or gender blindness in their discussions about different groups of people. And Kianga Yamato Taylor talks about this a lot in her book about black liberation, that it's part of trying to convey that America is a meritocracy to not refer to black people as the problem, but rather the inner city and, you know, drugs and so on as euphemisms for black people. And similarly, we have that in Australia, where when Abbott tried to close down a bunch of Aboriginal communities recently, he did not say that he was doing that because these communities are Aboriginal, but because they were economically unviable. Similarly, when Sunrise called for the Stolen Generations to make a return, they didn't say that this was because people innately, you know, black people need to be with white people. They just said, you know, it's because of negligence and so on. So actually it can be part of a reactionary agenda to pretend to be obliterating these categories as well. Okay, so moving on to the question of struggle, I think it's unsurprising, given this focus on ascriptive essentialism, that the anti-essentialists have a very dismissive and often outright hostile position to struggles against oppression. So Walter Ben Michaels says of anti-discrimination campaigns, the model of social justice is not that the rich don't make as much as the poor make. The model of social justice is that the rich make whatever they make, but an appropriate percentage of them should be blacks or women. So this is what he casts as, you know, the objective of all anti-discrimination struggles, all struggles against sexism and racism, is essentially to enable sections of that oppressed minority to be part of the ruling class. And similarly, Cedric Johnson, in his article about the Black Panthers Can't Save Us Now or something, where he disparages the Black Lives Matter movement as well as black struggles in the past, the argument he makes to defend that is that these struggles not only are actually just about elevating black people into official positions in society, but actually covering over or distracting from working class divisions. So he said, the Black Lives Matter movement forestalls the development of an analysis that would treat the black urban poor not as a separate and unique, but as a dramatic manifestation of the precarity that defines working class life more generally. So basically that the movement for black rights is distracting black working class people from their class. So this point's made over and over. And it is true that some initiatives and campaigns, don't challenge anything about capitalism and can be used to distract from class questions or to sanitise the abuse of working class people. Obama becoming president, and arguing that this would be a step forward for black people is a clear example of that. But there's a very clear difference between that kind of process and struggles from below that actually, challenge aspects of the capitalist system, I would argue. So, if you fail to see that there are dynamics inside these struggles against racism or against sexism that actually lead people closer to rather than further away from anti-capitalist conclusions, that means, you know, you can then justify abstaining from these struggles and not seeing anything progressive in them. But that is wrong. Actually, when people engage in struggles against oppression, it doesn't mean they'll make these conclusions, but the potential for people to draw the conclusion that they've got to go further than just the question of this aspect of oppression is raised for a bunch of reasons. Firstly, people gain confidence in the course of struggle. It involves taking control of something bigger than just your personal life. It brings you into contact with other people who, you know, share your principles, your passions, your beliefs, and, you know, that broadens your horizons. You develop a desire to actually understand the system you're living under and the system responsible for your oppression if you're involved in a struggle against it, because that is an important, question to face up to and work out how to proceed. But also people are forced to look for allies in struggles against oppression, and not in the kind of identity politics fashion of just sort of people they can morally browbeat or whatever, to sit subserviently in the corner while they talk about their experiences, but in the genuine strategic sense of needing allies who actually share an interest in fighting the same structures of oppression that you face. But also, it's through struggle that people are actually exposed to and compelled to reject the exact problems that the anti-essentialists point to. So it's through struggle that people can be pushed to reject the tokenism of sections of the ruling class who try to use a black or female veneer in order to maintain oppression. So just a recent example, a small one, but with the Me Too movement, one of the things that has happened because of it is that there's been sections of unionised workers, farm workers, women workers who are sexually assaulted by their bosses on these big agri farms that exist all across the US. And they've become a bit of a cause célèbre of the whole thing. And they had a protest recently against Wendy's that went for 5 days. They protested outside of Wendy's because Wendy's owns a bunch of these farms that directly commit these abuses against them. And Wendy's put out a statement in response to that, which was to say of these immigrant farm worker women that they are trying to cynically exploit the positive momentum that has been generated by and for women in the Me Too and Time's Up movement to advance their own special interests, their interests being working class women's interests. And so then there was obviously that created outrage from the working class women and a polarisation between the likes of the Wendy's CEO who wants to evoke the Me Too hashtag and people who want to do so for a different reason. So it's in the course of people politically engaging with the questions of their oppression and struggling against them that the things that so disturb the anti-essentialists can be challenged. And I think actually ironically, given Cedric Johnson's argument about the fact that things are worse now in terms of protesting for black rights than they were in the 60s, it's actually more the case these days that when people take up campaigns against things like racism, they're fairly immediately confronted with representatives from the ruling class who share their skin colour or gender, who they then need to understand as the enemy. So the Black Lives Matter protests in Baltimore that exploded there were immediately confronted with a black police chief, a black mayor on the other side of the barricades, and that's much more the case than it was in the 60s. Okay, so the next thing I want to deal with is a more theoretical argument, I suppose, made by another group of kind of people who can be classified as class-first Marxists, but that I think is also a reductionist approach to the questions of oppression. So there's an idea that is fashionable that Marxism is about economic categories and economic roles, and because oppression based on race and based on gender cannot be neatly fit into these, it's not therefore central to capitalism or to the fight by Marxists against it. So the late Ellen Menskin Wood, she had a well-known formulation along the lines of theoretically capitalism can survive without racism, however capitalism cannot survive without class exploitation. Now the argument behind this argument is that because the accumulation process only demands the most basic of labour inputs, it only demands that people be able to work, use their hands or their brains at the point of production, gender and race are totally irrelevant to their status as labour inputs in the accumulation process. David Harvey goes a lot further than Wood and actually argues that oppression is not part of the inner logic of capitalism for this reason, that it's not part of the production process, and that the evidence for this as well is that capitalism has proven itself able to adapt and to eradicate oppression. So he says, after all, capitalism in the United States in my lifetime has coped effectively with multiculturalism and gay rights, so why could it not go further on some of these other social and cultural issues, meaning, all forms of oppression based on race and gender. So for Harvey and co, even if they can understand that at various points oppression does have a utility for the capitalist class and it can become embedded and so on, they think that fundamentally it's not necessary and can be dispensed with. And I think this is wrong for a number of reasons. So firstly, it is true that the core dynamic of capitalism is to accumulate profits at the point of production, to accumulate capital. Because of this, though, the tasks of the capitalists and their, you know, the class that they're part of, the capitalist class, the task of them is to create the conditions that make the exploitation of human labour possible. That's the only way that they can fulfil that core dynamic of actually producing profits, accumulating capital. And that requires, you know, exploitation, obviously, but it also requires oppression. You need to, because there's competition between the capitalists over the profit share, over this process of accumulating capital, they need to find tools to oppress workers to make it easier to exploit them and to exploit them to a greater extent. So workers have to be oppressed as workers, and there are a bunch of ways in which workers are oppressed as workers. They have to be deprived of the ability to satisfy their basic needs by any other method than going to work. They have to be denied control over the production process and the products of their labour. They have to be dehumanised and humiliated and degraded at work and outside of work. But also, oppression on the basis of gender and race is actually important for all of this. At the level of production, bosses can benefit from having sections of the working class who are sort of more oppressed than others, because it can be used to increase exploitation, increase division between workers, and so on. But more broadly than the workplace, oppression is a central and indispensable part of disciplining the working class and the population throughout the rest of society. So it's often the basis on which the state justifies, you know, gender and race oppression is often the basis on which the state justifies violence domestically and internationally, and it's a very important part of the state's role in disorganising and alienating the working class, is to foist these different oppressions upon sections of it. So seeing the accumulation of capital as the foundational kind of drive and dynamic of capitalism does not mean that everything that is not precisely at every point in time involved in the production process is irrelevant to it. Rather, it's about seeing that that's the motive, the accumulation of capital, that makes sense of things like oppression. Oppression cannot be understood without understanding its role in the process of the accumulation of capital, and capital accumulation actually could not happen without the working class being oppressed in numerous ways. Now, that doesn't mean that Marxists can't understand the different forms of oppression. Particular forms of oppression might be transient. Some might be more important than others. Sometimes they play a less or more central role, either for bosses or for the state. But it's about establishing that, I suppose, theoretically, there is very, very, very little utility in the formulation that capitalism doesn't theoretically need racism or sexism. That is basically abstracting things to the point of saying that capitalism doesn't theoretically need a state to discipline or control the working class. So from this framework, I think it's also possible to see the way in which capitalism can adapt and change in the way that Harvey points to. We've seen anti-discrimination policies introduced in the workforce as well as the state, like the expansion of the right to vote. We've seen the ruling class relax their ideological commitment to certain forms of oppression. And in some cases, we've seen quite dramatic dismantling of systems of oppression, like the abolishment of formal apartheid in South Africa. But none of these things tell us that oppression in general, or the basis of none of this tells us that oppression in general is unnecessary to the system or can be done away with. There's actually clear limits to how much capitalism can adapt. Because the exploitation of the vast majority of humanity cannot function without division, repression, and the development of ways to increase the rate of exploitation. But also, the historical emergence of particular types of oppression means that they're structured into the material world. And without a reason to get rid of them, they're not just going to cease to exist. So history does not work on the basis of a series of clean slates being drawn up by every generation of the ruling class and then sort of strategically sitting down and conspiring like, which bits can we take up and which bits will we ignore? Actually, there's a historical continuation of structures and systems of oppression as well. And that's true even when there is a logic to getting rid of certain aspects of oppression. Just because that logic exists does not mean the ruling class will be able to coordinate their affairs and go about dismantling it. The ruling class is riven with divisions and competing logics. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about it, but there's a whole bunch of examples of where that problem that I outlined, I suppose, gets you into trouble again with the question of struggle, because there are various theorists and so on who have talked about how things like the black rights movements in the 60s and 70s in America were not, they did not win gains because of the struggle. They won gains because it became in the interest of the capitalist class to eradicate racism in particular sections of society. And I think there's actually no basis for that claim whatsoever, and it ends up denigrating the role of struggle in actually forcing changes upon the ruling class in terms of progressive changes around oppression, but also the limitations of those struggles, because actually the capitalist class does still very much depend on racism towards blacks in America. Okay, another point quickly to make is that a lot of this is based on a sort of moralism that class versus Marxists claim to reject but actually embody, because the point about economic reductionism is sort of that the economy is important and other social things are secondary or less important. And even the term class versus Marxism is sort of about imputing a moral value to class, as opposed to analytically putting it as the foundation for society. And I think that you can see the moralism when you look at some of the kind of proponents of like people who actually want to center questions of racism or sexism, but who similarly have a view of economy equals important, society equals secondary. So people like David Roediger, who goes around trying to defend the centrality of racism for the capitalist class, does so on the basis of saying that it is central to the way that bosses coordinate their affairs. So he talks about the production of difference and how important it is for bosses to exploit workers on the basis of race. Similarly, Lisa Vogel talks about this when she develops her theory about women's oppression. She has lots of good things to say about the way that women's work in the family contributes to the accumulation process. But in a desire to kind of put the women's oppression as central and therefore insert it into the accumulation process literally at the point of production, she classifies women's labour in the home as necessary labour, which actually is not a useful way of understanding necessary labour and surplus labour and so on. And I think that, like, it can't understand a whole bunch of oppressions to just look at whether or not bosses directly deploy them. So, for example, the oppression of Muslims. Muslims are not a substantial part of the working class in this country. There are not conventions of bosses who talk about how they can hyper-exploit Muslims at the point of production. They're only, you know, a small section of the working class, but they are hugely exploited, and they're exploited and oppressed by the capitalist state. So, you know, misunderstanding that that is actually central to society is, part of that. Okay, so I'll just wrap up now. Identity politics and class versus Marxism, I think, actually end up resting on the same fundamental errors. They sort of posit class and the economy in one corner and oppression and identity in the other, and then they back a winner, either theoretically or morally. And in terms of action, both of these perspectives point towards a partial and sectarian view of struggle. Identity politics, I think, clearly commits the greater crime because it rejects class struggle as a means for change and often actually sees the working class as a barrier. But class versus Marxists also often reject social struggles against oppression by arguing they're irrelevant to the class struggle, or worse, that they are a barrier to it. And I think that, if often class versus Marxists therefore have a very narrow view of what constitutes class struggle as well. It corresponds with having a very static view of the working class that basically says the working class will never be interested in taking up questions of oppression, or struggles of oppression will never manifest themselves inside the pure working class movement. And I think that writes off the potential for working class consciousness to develop, and it actually ends up justifying and excusing right-wing positions that are taken up by working class people. And there's a link to the theories that they kind of put forward in that, I reckon. David Harvey, as I was talking about, he thinks that, you know, racism and sexism are not part of the inner logic of capitalism. That leads him to conclude, even though he's someone who supports struggles against racism and sexism, His conclusion, though, is that often these struggles are antithetical to the material interests of the working class, because, you know, the inner logic of the system doesn't require oppression, therefore the working class exercising its material interests doesn't require standing up to oppression. And I think that is a really, you know, dangerous conclusion, because actually the whole history of struggle, and particularly revolutionary struggle, is that things are only really taken forward when sections of the working class start to identify with the struggles and plights of other people, of oppressed people, and to take on questions broader than the bread and butter questions of, you know, their workplace demands and conditions. And Marxists have to argue, and it's true, that it's in the interests of the working class to take on every the demands of every oppressed group that's made oppressed by capitalism, and that struggling on behalf of all of those groups is actually part of strengthening the class struggle and our side and our ability to have a successful revolution.